This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we pay a musical tribute to Labor Day.
We've got four of the greatest labor movement songs written in the first half of the 20th century that you can get on the album The Union Makes Us Strong by Peter K. Siegel and Eli Smith.
We examine some of the economic and agricultural reasons causing mass migration, including unaccompanied children, across the Mexico-U.S. border.
Well, this story goes back to the Reagan era of the 80s and the Contra Wars against popular revolutions in El Salvador and other Central American countries. The consequences of that devastation are still felt, and the United States' pressure on those countries, particularly El Salvador, is something that we're going to go into with our guest Eleanor Stein.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
The Israelis are practicing what they call the Dahiya Doctrine. What is this?
Well, at least many of us believe, and I think they are, practicing what's called the Dahiya Doctrine. For all our listeners, it's D-A-H-I-Y-A. And I like to call, when I talk about this, the Dahiya Doctrine, WikiLeaks, and Julian Assange, because the first cable that illustrated what the Dahiya Doctrine was or is came out of WikiLeaks. And it has to do with the way Israel fights its wars against Palestinians or others. Dahiya was a section of Beirut in Lebanon. And what the Israelis did in the 2006 war is they leveled that section entirely. Everything, every building, nothing stood. Disproportionate force is, of course, a key guideline to whether you're committing a war crime or not. It's a war crime to use disproportionate force. If you want to kill an enemy soldier in a neighborhood, you can't kill 10,000 civilians to kill one soldier. You can't kill 100. You have to use what's called proportional force. You can't go after civilian objects. You can't go after civilians or civilian homes. Well, the Dahiya Doctrine is what Israel actually practiced in 2006, leveling a neighborhood, a form of collective punishment, a form of what Israel is saying we're going to do to anybody that attacks us. We're going to show them it's not simply an eye for an eye. It's your entire body. It's your whole infrastructure. It's everything. That's 2006. Right after that devastation, demolishment of a village in a part of Beirut, rather, a general from Israel said, what we have now is the Dahiya Doctrine. And it's not just a proposal. That's what we do. And he actually said, we will use disproportionate force when we're fighting these wars. So that's an open and notorious admission of a war crime.
A so-called party admission.
It's a party admission from a legal term. But yes, it's basically saying we're committing a war crime. Because if you look at the Geneva Conventions, it says you can't use disproportionate force. And here you have a general saying, we're going to use disproportionate force. And that's not a proposal, he says. That's an approved doctrine. So now we flash forward to this recent war, if you want to call it that, the recent massacre that took place in Gaza. And, of course, we've been reading about what's going on there, and you look at the statistics from the Palestine Committee on Human Rights, for example. 2,168 people have been killed. 2,168. Of that, 76.6% are civilians. Three-quarters are civilians. Of that, 30% of the civilians killed are children. 23% overall are children. So of this 2,168, 24% roughly were children. So that's what you would call the practice of the Dahiya Doctrine. The overwhelming use of force, disproportionate use of force, that winds up killing way more civilians than appropriate military targets. Now, the second part of that, of course, is a report that came out of the United Nations recently. Someone named Pernille Ironside, who's in charge of UNICEF for the UN, and she's been spending her time in Gaza, gave a very important press conference last week about the damage that's going on in Gaza. And the statistics were completely numbing. The main one that I take away from it is 400,000 people have been displaced in Gaza. That's basically one out of four people have been displaced. One out of four of a population of 1.8 million. Of that, 17,000 houses have been destroyed, 100,000 people completely homeless in Gaza. How long will it take them to rebuild that, assuming they ever get to rebuild it? She says a minimum of 18 years to rebuild it. So what you've seen is the utter and complete use of disproportionate force in Gaza, the Dahiya Doctrine. And I want to just close this segment to say, why are we standing by and allowing this to happen? Here we have a war crime being committed in front of our faces, admission by Israel it's doing it, a disclosure by WikiLeaks showing again the importance of WikiLeaks, and who's in prison or in exile or in an embassy? Julian Assange for exposing this type of document while the people committing these war crimes are going scot-free. And they're going scot-free for one major reason, and that's because the country we live in, the United States, gives them its full support. They can commit war crimes, and there's nothing or very little that people can do about it, at least in any of the so-called agencies, whether it's the UN or the UN courts or international courts. So the tragedy here is one that obviously Palestinians are being killed en masse. Secondly, that war crimes are being committed openly and notoriously. And third, that the country, the United States, that we live in, is the fundamental supporter of those war crimes. And by that, I want to say, by that, every single member of Congress and the Senate and the House and Obama, who's approved it, who voted to continue to aid Israel in carrying out these war crimes, which is what that aid is doing, the military aid, is an aider and abettor of war crimes. Absolutely not any question under international law. So the key here for us in America, certainly, is to get the U.S. To stop its criminal support of Israel.
Heidi, we have an update on the former H.R.A.P. Brown, one of the founders of SNCC, Imam Jamil. Tell us how he's doing.
Well, listeners may recall that about 6 or 8 weeks ago, he was not in good physical condition. And thanks to an enormous outpouring from supporters across the country, he was transferred to a Bureau of Prisons medical facility. Now, a recent report has indicated that he has early stage myeloma and will not be receiving cancer drugs, radiation, or other medical interventions at this time. But a doctor who reported on his condition has indicated or stressed the importance of Imam Jamil's condition being closely monitored with continued and regular biopsies at 2 to 3 month intervals in order to check to see if there are increased levels of myeloma cells. We here at Law and Disorder are deeply concerned that the Bureau of Prisons may consider returning Imam Jamil to the Florence Maximum Security Facility, where he will not receive the proper medical care and follow-up that his condition requires and that is the morally right thing to do. But I think it's important to acknowledge, due to the outpouring of support, he has received a much-needed biopsy and timely results at a proper medical facility. We're asking listeners to spread the word. The continued efforts are needed to advocate for continued medical care and the proper follow-up he needs. We'll post the information on the website of where people should call and send letters of support.
We had a good victory a little over a week ago, Heidi, on the Brooklyn Bridge case.
Indeed, we did, Michael. Our listeners will recall that hundreds of people were arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge in the early days of the Occupy Wall Street protests. A federal appeals court just ruled that these protesters can proceed with a class action lawsuit against the New York Police Department. Our own friend Marv or Hayden Hilliard, who's a lawyer for the plaintiffs with the group the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund in D.C., brought this case. And after some obstruction, not surprisingly, from the city, a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit has said that the lawsuit can proceed. You may recall, Michael, that one of the issues was whether or not the police had indicated by their actions that the protesters could proceed onto the walkway of the bridge. And what had happened was, leading up to that entrance, police had actually led protesters through red lights, which most of the protesters saw as a so-called green light to go ahead and enter the bridge. The New York Police Department, despite this positive ruling, is continuing to arrest people during political protests, even though we have a new mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, and a new police commissioner, Bill Bratton. Now, Michael, even though this three-judge panel has given the protesters a significant victory, there are indications that the protesters may still face some roadblocks down the road. In order to recover damages, they need to establish that particular defendants acted unreasonably in arresting them, that would be the police officers, or directing their arrest. The judges in this case wrote that they thought they would have a difficult time doing that. But that said, they're in excellent hands with the Partnership for Civil Justice, and I think that if anyone can bring this case to a positive resolution, it would be the partnership.
Well, it was an outrageous case. It's terrific that they took it. I mean, the cops intentionally entrapped 700 people on the bridge and then arrested them. Police Commissioner in New York, William Bratton, he's a retread. He was the police commissioner under Giuliani. He's the guy that developed the broken windows theory of policing, where you arrest people for very minor crimes on the false premise that they're going to go out and commit major crimes if you don't nip them in the bud. And that's what led to the death of the man in Staten Island for selling a cigarette. Well, Heidi, we have a special treat on this, the 120th anniversary of Labor Day, and we're going to play four great union movement songs to honor the 125th anniversary.
Now, Michael, where did Labor Day come from?
Well, it's 120 years ago, and there was a lot of working class unrest and labor unrest and strike actions in those days. The big one being the Pullman strike that was led by Eugene V. Debs, which everybody's heard of. President Taft wouldn't lift a finger. Debs went to prison for 18 months for leading that strike, but he did sign into law Labor Day law. It's just like the Martin Luther King Day. You know, there's a big struggle to get that as a national holiday.
Michael, tell us a bit about the four songs we're going to hear.
You know, I'd be happy to. But first, I thought that we should read a little bit from the liner notes. The album these songs come from is called The Union Makes Us Strong by Peter K. Siegel and Eli Smith. Full disclosure, Eli's my son. And they made this album about a year ago. And Cliff Connor, the radical labor historian, wrote the liner notes. And I think we should put these songs into context.
Reading from the liner notes of the CD called The Union Makes Us Strong, it says, "The historical importance of these songs lies in the role they played in the creation of the union movement in the United States in the first half of the 20th century. They were instrumental in propagating the attitudes and ideas, the, quote, class consciousness, that led working men and women by the thousands to recognize the need to stand together in solidarity. In short, they shaped a politicized working-class culture based more upon social than individual values. In a more direct sense, some of these songs served as organizing tools, calling on their listeners to join an organization or to support a cause or take a specific action. These songs also serve us, the present-day audience, as historical documents that help us not only to understand, but to feel the wretched conditions that impelled workers to form and join unions. A vocal performance conveys the emotional impact the songs had on those who originally sang and heard them far better than words on the page of a written or printed document. Like the union movement itself, the music it produced depended both on talented individuals and on large numbers of working people. Songwriters and singers gave the first breath of life to the songs, but it was the mass audience of workers who kept them alive, nurturing and disseminating them throughout the workplaces, union halls, picket lines, and taverns. In many cases, unions consciously promoted songs by encouraging singers to sing them, organizing labor choruses, and printing the lyrics in flyers and songbooks."
So our first song is going to be one by the great labor organizer Joe Hill called There Is Power in the Union.
Let's take a listen.
Would you have freedom from wage slavery and join in the grand industrial band? Would you from misery and hunger be free? Then come do your share, lend a hand. There is power, there is power in a band. That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand. Would you have mansions of gold in the sky and live in a shack away in the back? Would you have wings up in heaven to fly and starve here with rags on your back? That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand.
Michael, who was Joe Hill?
He was a Swedish immigrant, Americanized his name. It was Joe Hillström. There's a monument, actually, to him over in Sweden. And Joe Hill organized miners out in Utah, and he was good at it. He was also the most famous and greatest songwriter for the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies, the IWW, the Wobblies. He was framed up on a murder charge. There was a worldwide outcry, 1915. The bosses had him executed in Utah. He wrote in his will, "I have one last request. After I'm dead, take my body across the state line. I don't want to be found dead in Utah." The next song we're going to hear is a Joe Hill song again, called "The Preacher and the Slave." Long-haired preachers come out every night, try to tell you what's wrong and what's right, but when asked for something to eat, they will answer with words that are sweet. "You will eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky. Chop some wood, it'll do you good. You'll get pie in the sky when you die." It was mocking the Salvation Army that tried to sidetrack workers, telling them, you know, put in your 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, and you'll get your reward when you die. That kind of
meaning you go to heaven.
You go to heaven, and there you'll get your reward. Well, Joe Hill mocked that in this wonderful satiric song, "The Preacher and the Slave." He called the Salvation Army the Starvation Army. Let's give a listen.
Preachers come out every night, try to tell you what's wrong and what's right. But when asked how about something to eat, they will answer with voices so sweet. "You'll eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky, way up high, work and pray. Live on hay, you'll get high in the sky when you die." And the Starvation Army, they play, and they sing and they dance and they pray, till they've got all your coin on the drum. They will tell you when you're on the bum. You'll eat by and by that glorious land above the sky, way up high, work and pray, live on hay, you'll get high in the sky. come out. And they sing and they dance and they shout. Give your money to Jesus, they sing. He will cure all diseases today. You lead by and by in that glorious land above the sky, way up high, work and pray, live on hay. You'll get high in the sky when you die. Working men of all countries unite, side by side, for freedom we shall fight. When this world and its wealth we have gained, to the grafters we'll sing this refrain. You lead by and by, when you've learned how to cook and to fry and bake a pie, chop some wood, it'll do you good. And you'll eat in the sweet by and by, you wise guy.
Michael, our next song is about Mother Jones. Tell us about her.
Well, Mother Jones is one of the founders of the IWW in 1905. She subscribed to that famous first sentence in their proclamation: the working class and the capitalist class have nothing in common. She was a militant supporter of workers, mostly on the East Coast, garment workers, and mainly coal miners. She lived to be 100 years old. She died in 1930. She lost her husband and her children in a flu epidemic years before, and she went on alone to organize miners and support them in solidarity in the coal mines in Pennsylvania. And there's a famous story about her. She was riding through town in Mona, West Virginia, going to the workers' headquarters. They were out on strike in a coal mine there, and two thugs from the coal mine owners' organization stopped her horse. She was in a horse and buggy, and they stopped her horse. They grabbed it by the bridle. They turned the horse around, and they said, "Get out of town." She reached under her red gingham dress, pulled out a pistol, put it at the head of one of these thugs, and said, "Turn my horse around and get out of here." And they did. Mother Jones was tough. It's a wonderful song. We don't know who wrote it. It was sung, ironically, by Gene Autry in the 40s. Eli rediscovered it. It's called "The Death of Mother Jones."
Let's have a listen.
Champion of labor was known in every land. She fought for right and justice. She took a noble stand. Thank you. clear us of every danger. She hated that which was wrong. She never gave up fighting until her breath was gone. This noble leader of labor has gone to a better land, while the hard-working miners, they miss her guiding hand. May the miners all work together to carry out her plan and bring back better conditions for every laboring man.
Michael, our concluding song is about Harry Bridges. Who was he?
Well, and the song was written by a number of people, including Pete Seeger, in 1940. Harry Bridges was an illegal immigrant from Australia. He came to the West Coast. He organized the International Longshoremen, Workers, and Warehouse Union, the ILWU, which is still active today. And because he was so effective, of course, the bosses wanted to deport him. And for 20 years, they were in the courts trying to deport him. There were lawyers' guild lawyers out there supporting him. They never succeeded. The song we have is about a strike that that he led against a company union. Company union is a union that the company allows, but they totally control it. And they had all the workers on the docks there carry around a little blue book, which the workers called a think book. And that book kept track of the workers' records. The workers struck, and they built a huge bonfire, and they threw their Fink books into the bonfire. And this is a song that Pete Seeger and others wrote about Harry Bridges in support of him.
Let's take a listen.
Let me tell you of a sailor. Harry Bridges is his name, an honest union leader.
Michael, I understand that Harry Bridges was the leader of the CIO.
The Congress of Industrial Organizations. It later merged with the American Federation of Labor, and it became the AFL-CIO, which is what we know it as today. But the CIO originally were industrial workers. You see, in the old days, unions were just unions of craft workers. They were like the upper strata of workers, and they wouldn't allow in the people that worked in the mill or the mines or chopping trees in the forest. It was the IWW that first organized them, and then it was the CIO that organized them. And here's where a great hero of mine, A.J. Musty, comes in. Because in 1934, A.J. Musty led the Toledo Autolite strike. It was one of the great strikes in 34. There was a general strike in San Francisco, and there was a third huge movement uprising in Minneapolis. There was a general strike.
At the same time.
General strike in Minneapolis. All in 1934, and that led to the formation of the CIO. We credit those people out in Minneapolis. One of them was, a lot of them were ex-IWW members who were in the Socialist Workers Party then. They had that tradition of class struggle, and they formed a unit of the Teamsters, which represented workers wall-to-wall. It didn't matter whether you were a privileged worker or just a lowly worker. They represented all the workers in Minneapolis, and that model became the model for the Teamsters Union that spread to 11 states in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. It later got corrupted by Jimmy Hoffa and others, but initially it was a militant class struggle union. The union that A.J. Musty led in 34 in Toledo, same kind of union. The ILWU out in San Francisco, you know, they did something. Heidi, you'll know about this. Remember the Zim ship, that Israeli ship that tried to dock in Oakland?
Yes.
3 weeks ago?
Yes.
Well, that ship wasn't allowed to dock. Why? Because the ILWU workers honored the picket line of the pro-Palestinian solidarity people. That ship couldn't offload. So the ILWU is still around. The tradition of Harry Bridges is still around, of A.J. Musty. That's what we celebrate on today, the 120th anniversary of Labor Day.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
We've heard a lot of news reports lately about the mass migration of unaccompanied young children coming across the Mexican-U.S. border. But in those reports, we don't hear about the pressures, the economic pressures, that are driving this emigration. Today, we look at some of the reasons that cause these children to flee, particularly from El Salvador, but also from Honduras and Guatemala. There are organizations that are helping El Salvadorian communities find economic alternatives to the American-imposed Central American Free Trade Agreement. One organization helps poor farmers grow and market seeds for corn and beans. The organization is called the Mangrove Association, where the Salvadorian government buys the seeds and then distributes them for free to 400,000 farmers. And these are non-GMO seeds, which are better and preferred by the local communities. In El Salvador, the government had to fight the United States in order to distribute these seeds. We talk today with returning guest professor of law, Eleanor Stein, who is on the board of Eco Viva, one of the organizations involved in the seed project. Eleanor Stein teaches at Albany Law School and SUNY Albany, in conjunction with the Environmental and Atmospheric Sciences Department at the State University of New York.
Eleanor Stein, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Now, we've had you on in the past talking about environmental and legal issues. Tell us how you got involved in our topic today, El Salvador and some of the root causes causing emigration.
My primary work over the last 10 years has been centered on climate change and what can be done to reverse that trend and to change the political climate in which those decisions get made. And I was interested in this project in El Salvador because I understood that it was based in some local community groups in a very, very poverty-stricken rural area, and it's the southwestern part of the country. and that they were using very creative methods to develop more of a sustainable agriculture and also to take measures related to adaptation of their region from the results of climate change, which have been very severe in Central America and especially in El Salvador.
And you've, in fact, been involved with a group called Ecoviva.
Yes, the U.S. group that has been in existence for about 16 years that provides solidarity and material support to several community-based organizations in El Salvador. And it's the chairman of the board is Jeff Haas, who is a lawyer in Chicago, from Chicago, who has a long history of solidarity work in the U.S. and internationally. And he invited me to go, and I was very interested in looking into these environmental projects.
Yes, and we've had Jeff on the show related to his book on the assassination of Fred Hampton.
Yeah. Sure.
Eleanor, it's in introducing you, we talked about CAFTA and looking at this as an alternative to CAFTA. What is CAFTA, and how is this an alternative?
Well, I'm not sure I would describe it as an alternative, but CAFTA is the equivalent to NAFTA in the context of Central America and the Dominican Republic. So it is a treaty, a trade treaty, to which the U.S. and all of Central America are parties and the Dominican Republic. And it governs very much like NAFTA or the World Trade Organization rules. It governs the requirements for procurement of goods and services by governments in those regions. And in the name of removing trade barriers, it also really runs afoul of any local government's attempts to use issues to address human rights or to address climate change or other environmental concerns.
And in this instance, as I understand it, Eleanor, the El Salvadorian people were trying to produce and distribute for free seeds that were non-GMO seeds, but were better seeds than they could get from the American government. And the American government said, no, you can't do that. And moreover, the $238 million that we got in the pipeline for you, we're not going to give you unless you take on these seeds from this subsidiary of Monsanto. So could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, that's a good summary of the situation. El Salvador is a very, very poor country. It's still living with the results of a civil war that went from 1979 to 1992 and resulted in the death of almost 80,000 people. And when I call it a civil war, that doesn't really capture the full involvement of the U.S. government in supporting the right-wing counterinsurgency forces, which really kept this war going for that long and led to such a high death toll. And the country was really devastated by this war. It has been in the process of reconstructing itself ever since. And in the mid-90s, the FMLN, which had led the left-wing insurgency during the war period, became a political party and has run candidates for office. And this past June 1st, the second Salvadoran administration took office. President Salvador Sanchez Serran was a comandante in the mountains and is now the president of the country. And the FMLN governments have, the last government was also an FMLN government, and they have put in place a seed program that began in 2012 that was an attempt to deal with the tremendous problems of food insecurity, agricultural non-sustainability, and poverty and lack of economic opportunity that exist in the rural areas. And the program basically encouraged the creation of a whole new industry in El Salvador, which are cooperatives that produce seeds that are locally grown, they're non-GMO, and they are apparently more successful than the Monsanto varieties, and they have a higher germination rate, and they are much more hardy in the very difficult conditions of growth in El Salvador.
How does the Central America Free Trade Agreement just affect what you said, both the poverty, what's happened on the farms, as well as perhaps what's happened with the Monsanto seeds? Is there some relationship?
Yeah, the relationship is that until fairly recently, El Salvador had been procuring almost all of its seeds from Monsanto subsidiary in the region and for very few other producers. And basically, they were pretty much captive of the Monsanto empire and were, you know, arguably in violation of CAFTA because this was a direct procurement without bidding and so on. But the U.S. needless to say, never objected to that, thought that was fine. And only recently, when they started this new program to buy seeds from these local cooperatives that turned out to work much better for El Salvador and were cheaper, then the U.S. Trade Representative and the American Chamber of Commerce weighed in and said, wait a minute, you must be violating the free trade agreement because you're choosing local producers rather than Monsanto. And in fact, based on that assumption and that charge, El Salvador was being denied a major aid package that was coming through the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which was holding that aid up on condition that the Salvadoran government adopt really a whole range of, you know, neoliberal so-called reforms to try to make the conditions of investment in El Salvador more hospitable to U.S. corporations. And one of them was open up your seed procurement process so that Monsanto can play in that area again.
Eleanor, you said that there was a attempt to at least hold up some kind of aid that was going to El Salvador, maybe under CAFTA or from something called the Millennial something. Can you explain that? Because of what happened with the Monsanto seeds and wanting to buy local.
Sure. The Millennium Challenge Corporation is a U.S. government agency, which is basically a dispenser of aid in the form of grants to countries that have been defined as sort of emerging, potentially successful democracies by the State Department. The Philippines is another one. There are a couple of countries in Africa and El Salvador. This aid package has been conditioned really every time, for every country where it has been offered, has been conditioned on the local government making certain changes, legislative changes, to bring the economy of the recipient government more in line with U.S. neoliberal trade policies. So, for example, they tried to get the Salvadoran legislature to vote to privatize water in the country, which would have been, has been, a complete disaster wherever it's been done. South Africa, Bolivia tried it, and there was practically a revolution over it. The Salvadoran legislature, in the end, refused to do this. But they also have required other concessions from the Salvadorans, one of which was that they open up their seed procurement program so that Monsanto could basically reestablish its monopoly over the provision of seeds. And this is one of the few places in the world, by the way, where a region has been able to secede from the Monsanto monopoly on seed production. And that makes this, so far, this victory a really significant step.
How is the victory won? And what does it mean? They're still going to get the aid, is that right?
It appears that they will get the aid. There are one or two other conditions that have to be fulfilled. But for now, and I'm saying this because it's not a permanent agreement, but for now, the U.S. Trade Representative has said they will not hold up the Millennium Challenge Corporation aid, which is almost $300 million, for any change in the seed program. And that was accomplished by a tremendous advocacy effort by the Salvadoran group, the Mangrove Association, which is the group that we work with, by Ecoviva, which is the organization that I am now associated with and that does a tremendous amount of advocacy on behalf of the Mangrove Association, and other groups, including Oxfam and C-Space, that actually got a letter by a number of Democratic congresspeople written to the State Department objecting to holding up aid based on trying to destroy, basically, a local program that was having tremendous success. I mean, they were being able to provide for free to more than 400,000 farmers, poor farmers in El Salvador, these very high-quality seeds. And this is a concrete, effective local program that is really combating hunger and food insecurity. And it's at a time when tens of thousands of children from El Salvador are trying to emigrate to the United States because of the conditions not only of violence but of poverty and lack of opportunity in El Salvador.
Yeah, you're taking me in a couple of different directions when I want to go. Question. So let's talk about that for a second, as long as you mentioned migration from Salvador. And, of course, all we read about is violence and gangs and that. But you're saying there's another underlying cause why we're seeing all these young people, children, leave El Salvador. Can you explore that a little bit?
Yes, and I think both the violence and the poverty and lack of economic development are both rooted in the history of the war in El Salvador and the history of the U.S. role in that war. this country was devastated. It was, its agricultural capacity was really destroyed by years of war, and the conditions of life were so unstable that thousands and thousands of Salvadorians fled to the United States during that war and came to communities in the U.S. and found, you know, lack of opportunities there and violence and the gangs of L.A. waiting for them. And those gangs have now been transplanted back to El Salvador. I think the underlying condition, not only for the immigration but for the violence itself, is the lack of infrastructure, the lack of development, the lack of opportunity that continues to haunt this country, which was under the rule of an oligarchy for 60 or 70 years, and is really now, for the first time, has a chance to have a really democratically elected government that's rooted in local community development projects like the one I'm describing, trying to make a go of it and to find a way to, you know, grow a more viable economy for its citizens.
Yeah, Eleanor, I remember when the right wing, which Ronald Reagan's administration supported. In fact, Reagan, what did he call George Washington?
That's right, Roberto d'Aubuisson.
Yeah.
George Washington of his country.
They assassinated the leading Catholic Archbishop of El Salvador as he was serving Mass.
Exactly.
So that's unbelievable, the tragedy that the United States government caused. And when you went down there, how do people treat you, being an American, what it was like to go down there?
Well, I spent a lot of time apologizing for the actions of my government. But, of course, people there were very hospitable and very happy to have us there. And Ecoviva, which is, you can see, get more information about it on its wonderful website, which is echo-viva.org. Works very closely with these community organizations and has established a long track record of a very principled relationship. You know, I'm not telling you about charity projects or, you know, U.S. go and build something in this for these poor people and help them. It's really supporting the work that the people in these communities are doing themselves, and they're providing the leadership. And they're amazing. Their understanding of climate change, the way that they're approaching the problems of climate change for their communities, is far more sophisticated and creative than anything I've seen in the United States, where I've been working on this issue for many years.
Eleanor, I want to step back for a second and see if I really understand an overview of this. I understand the U.S. role, as you and Michael have discussed, and of course we were all involved in opposing that role during the 80s. But I'm trying to figure out CAFTA and its relationship to the seeds.
Okay.
And then what else Ecoviva is doing. So we have CAFTA, which we understand the Central America Free Trade Agreement is an agreement that, as you said, requires a certain amount of what we call neoliberalism with regard to trade. So can you explain that and then explain, I understand how the seeds then work into that and what other topics work into that. But first, what is it meant when you say CAFTA and the neoliberal trade agreement?
Well, CAFTA, Article 9.2, General Principles, says basically no country, no party to the treaty can give more favorable treatment to local producers or suppliers than it does to any other producers or suppliers from any other party nation. So in the context of this program, where you have a profoundly poor, underdeveloped country trying to build up a local industry and a local agriculture after decades of destabilization and environmental devastation and degradation, the CAFTA is being used to say you cannot build up a local program at the expense of a transnational corporation like Monsanto. They have to be treated identically. And in fact, the Salvadorans say, and I think they've made a convincing argument, that their program actually doesn't really discriminate against Monsanto. If Monsanto can provide seeds as good as those that are provided by the cooperatives, then they could win the bid. If they had a comparable price.
So that's on the seeds, but are there other issues like the seeds that either Ecoviva is involved or other issues that are going on this?
Oh, there are numerous issues like this going on in El Salvador. One of the most important has to do with a gold mining project in the northern part of El Salvador, which is where multinational corporations are running gold mine projects that are having a devastating effect on the Salvadoran water supply. It's a very water-intensive industry, and Salvadorans have been fighting this for years. There's many issues like this. This one happens to be one where people were able to actually prevail, at least for now, and hopefully move forward with this very vibrant new industry. And there, it's like traveling back into the 1940s in the South, or, you know, we didn't meet a single family that had indoor plumbing. People are living under really difficult conditions. Children can't go to school because the areas are too remote and the roads are too bad. So a $300 million grant, which doesn't sound like much if you live in New York City, has enormous potential. And holding it up to ensure that Monsanto has a toehold has really, you know, been unacceptable. And in the end, the U.S. had to give in.
Eleanor, I read that there's an impending threat to some of the local organizing projects related to the Millennium Challenge Corporation and a big investment scheme that would affect a couple of regions.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, the Millennium Challenge Corporation is, you know, it started with the United Nations Millennium Goals at the turn of this century. Which were very lofty goals related to eradication of global poverty. But it devolved in this country to a U.S. government corporation that basically aids investment and through aid and what the Obama administration calls the public-private partnerships. And these public-private partnerships have a tendency to be, let's say they're more private than public, and they're more aimed at safeguarding the investment opportunities for U.S. corporations than they are at actually meeting the real development needs of the subject countries. So in El Salvador, one of the main projects that is targeted by this grant is the construction of a superhighway from the airport to the Pacific coast, which is very lovely and very underdeveloped from the point of view of, you know, a beautiful beach with surfing and, you know, the potential of that to become another Cancun, right? But I think it's up to the people of El Salvador to decide if that's the kind of development they want. I doubt that many of the people we met with would say, yes, the main thing we want is a superhighway to the luxury hotels when their children can't even make it to school.
Right.
Eleanor Stein, when you were visiting in El Salvador, you saw what they were able to do in terms of combating climate change. And you said before that you thought their understanding of it was more sophisticated, really, than people up in the United States. Talk to us about that. What are they doing to try to reverse the process?
Well, of course, El Salvador is not a major producer of greenhouse gas emissions, but it is a major victim of the results of those emissions. So they have traditionally been subject to storms coming from the Pacific coast, and now they're subject to storms also coming from the Atlantic coast. So they're, you know, in a little spit of land in a very vulnerable place. And they have put a tremendous amount of effort into the regions we visited, which was the Lower Lempa region, into building an adaptation plan. They're subject to terrible flooding, devastating flooding that's killed hundreds of people in the country in the last few years. And they've put a lot of effort into an evacuation plan, which is very community-based, very sophisticated, and has worked remarkably well. So in floods that have led to loss of life in all the rest of the country, in this region, they have an early warning system with a radio station run by teenagers. They have a very community-based evacuation system, so every elderly person knows which teenager is coming to get her in a boat and when they'll be there, and it's really organized from the ground up as opposed to a lot of the measures that we see, which are very much from the top down and may not get to the communities that are most at risk. That's just one example.
Yeah, it's an example they could have picked up on in Red Hook during our last storm.
Not to mention in your neighborhood and during Sandy.
I was a refugee. I was a climate refugee.
You were.
In New York
and
City.
You could have, if you lived in El Salvador, you probably would have done better.
As usual, it's wonderful to hear from you, and this is just some really heartening examples of the right thing happening despite corporate enterprises trying to take over, especially on the SEED initiative.
Take over with the help of the United States.
Exactly.
With a free trade agreement, right, and a war. But Eleanor, you mentioned EcoViva, and I just want people to be able to help and support. So
good.
Tell us about that website and what people can do in going to that.
Well, as you can tell, this project needs a lot of help, and they run wonderful tours twice a year where you can go there and learn about it. You can donate to EcoViva, and the funds there go directly to the Mangrove Association and the other community organizations in El Salvador. And the best way to do that is to go to their website, www.eco-viva.org, EcoViva.org. It's a great website, very informative. You'll learn a lot about the country. And they really are trying to develop a method of progressive government and progressive development, which is community-based and local-based and environmentally tremendously conscious, that I think is pretty unique in the world, and I think is something we all need to support.
Oh, it's an exciting example that we need. So thank you, Eleanor, very much.
Thank you very much.
Have a great day.
Thank you, Eleanor.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.